Most of the times where I've discussed healthcare on the show lately, it's been about the politics or perhaps the finances. And I'll talk about those things a bit with my guest. But today we're also going to talk about the practice of medicine. Though Atul Gawande is a best-selling author, a Harvard professor, and an innovator in best practices for the WHO, he is very much a doctor, performing 250-plus surgeries a year. Other careers he considered along the way included philosophy and politics, and he still has a hand in both. But it is his writing that has reached so many. He writes about the physical realities of medicine, as well as the widest context in which it takes place. He asks questions, and he tells stories. Medicine is just one area of our world that is becoming so complex that even the most expert professionals struggle to master the tasks they face. Neither longer training or more advanced technologies are able to prevent costly and painful errors. In his new book, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, Gawande offers disarmingly simple remedy, the checklist. Pilots have used checklists for years to fly aircraft of mind-boggling sophistication. And now checklists are being adopted in hospitals around the world. In surgery, for instance, this simple 90-second practice has cut the rate of fatalities by more than a third. I read in a recent interview in Harvard Magazine that a framed copy of Sylvia Plath's poem, The Surgeon at 2 a.m., stands on the desk in his office. Her surgeon's words in the poem, quote, "I worm and hack in a purple wilderness," unquote. Gawande says he likes the Plath poem because it casts the surgeon in an ambiguous light. I'm reading again from that interview. "Most writing about people in medicine cast them as either heroes or villains," he says. "That poem captures the surgeon as a merely human, slightly bewildered, a little bit benighted person in a world that is ultimately beyond his control." Atul Gawande is a staff member of Brigham and Women's Hospital, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and the New Yorker magazine. He served as a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton White House from 92 to 93. He's associate professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health, research director for the BWH Center for Surgery and Public Health, and the director of the World Health Organization's Global Challenge for Safer Surgical Care. In 2006, he received a MacArthur Award for his research and his writing. His first book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, was a finalist for the National Book Award. His second, Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, was a New York Times bestseller. And his newest, as I said, is The Checklist Manifesto. Welcome, Atul Gawande.
Terrence, thanks for having me on.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. Tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today. For instance, when did you know you wanted to be a doctor? When a surgeon? When a writer?
Well, I'm the son of two Indian doctors. So if you know Indian families, you're thinking about whether you're going to become a doctor or not from the time before you're born.
Yes, they're proud to announce the birth of their son, Dr. Atul Gawande.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. There's a certain amount of expectation there. And I was actually trying along the way to rebel against it. When I got my master's in philosophy, it was hoping I could become a philosophy professor, and I just didn't understand the questions, let alone be able to offer anything like original answers. So when I ended up coming to work in Washington in government, it was also with an interest in really where politics meets ideas. And I had great experience. I learned a lot about how change happens, and about the importance of ideas in driving our efforts to make things better. I also learned about the ways in which I didn't want to be just staff for other people, and I ended up coming back to medicine, where I was very comfortable having grown up with two doctors and knowing that world, and, you know, liking important parts of it. But what I ended up doing when I returned, finished medical school, my plans were to work in problems around public health, never expected to like surgery, but then I was in the operating room, and the mix of the blood and the guts, the sense of having to have skill and technique that you could master some set of very tangible skills that no one could take away, that was very attractive to me. A second thing was really attractive was the character of the people. Surgeons were people who had a great deal of confidence in themselves and yet also made mistakes, had things go wrong, had to figure out how to handle it and how to take responsibility for it. They were people who felt that action was better than inaction, even when they knew that they didn't know everything, that their skills were imperfect. And I felt like that was the kind of person I myself wanted to become. That led me down that road.
Yeah, I remember reading that quote. I was going to ask you about that thing of the this was a thing that I thought might help me become the person I wanted to become. In that sense of balancing that fallibility and yet action?
In a funny way, I felt like my time in Washington was watching politicians grapple with the uncertainty of the world. There's knowledge about what can be done, and so you're trying to pull, you know, a very contentious world towards better solutions that are recognized, something like covering the population. We've been working for a century for trying to accomplish health reform to make sure that everybody has access to health care. But then you're also working in areas where there's just plain only rudiments of information. How do we actively control the costs in ways that also improve the quality of care for people? This is an area we're going to be struggling towards, and we want to have forward progress. And whether it's the surgeons or the politicians that I've watched the best seem to be able to grapple with the uncertainties, push forward, make wise decisions, while recognizing at times they're going to fail and live with that fallibility.
I'm struck. I would think one of the other things, just looking at those two choices where you're both trying to do the greater good and so on, is the immediacy of surgery. The action is now. The feedback is moment to moment. And I had a friend when I used to be in the entertainment industry who had been in the record business and looked at the film business and just said, it takes too long.
Well, I don't think I could give up surgery because it is that sense of accomplishment. I've been working, writing, thinking, pushing on health reform for a decade. I was through the debacle of the Clinton administration when we made our efforts at it and failed. And the one thing every time I finished my day in the operating room is I felt like I accomplished something, where you're never quite clear on what we do with writing or thinking about public health, that we are getting as far as we want to.
Are you familiar with the work of Mihai Csikszentmihalyi?
No.
He's the person who did the research and wrote the book Flow. Flow, which you may have heard of.
Yes, absolutely.
Of course. He says three conditions: clear goals, good feedback, and a stretch between challenge and skill.
Very.
What you know and what you're pushing. And it turned out that people think of rock climbers, ballet dancers, that sort of thing. Surgeons were very, very high on the flow.
There are, and in fact, I write in this new book about the moment when you actually achieve flow in an operating room. And it's not an individual moment. That's the really interesting thing, is you have a half dozen people that have to be working together, and there are only certain moments when you actually achieve that pit crew-like flow, when everybody's anticipating one another, the problems you hit seem to be ones that you move through effortlessly, and it's like a symphony. But I had always assumed that you could not achieve that except by the luck of the people you have gathered that day, your chemistry, your mood. And so the idea that you could really achieve that more commonly in ways that made it more likely you also happen to be saving people's lives and not just having fun that day in the operating
right.
room was part of what I've been very interested in.
How do you compare writing and surgery? We've talked about one difference, which is at the end of the day, you don't know whether you've accomplished anything
yeah.
writing.
Yeah, I feel like they're completely different. Surgery is partly physical, partly making momentary judgment, and a lot about teamwork.
That's right.
Writing is solitary. It is in my head, and it allows for constant revision. I'm an okay writer, but I've gotten better and better at being a good reviser and constantly rework in a way that you can't do in the operating room. You get first draft in the operating
yeah,
room.
Right. Each one can build on the previous one, but that day, that moment is that moment.
That's absolutely right.
Cut in for a second, because I read that you're just going along with your rewriting thing, that your first New Yorker piece in 1998 took 9 months and went through 22 rewrites.
That's right. The first draft, I really worked painfully on this for 2 months. It's the longest I'd worked on a piece, and I thought, this is
New
killer.
Yorker, yeah.
This is killer. And they said, this is great. It's got, I think I can see a lot of promise here. You can probably use a little work at the beginning, and in the end, that's really got to go. And then in the middle, I don't know where, you know, but I'm sure we'll get somewhere. And it was 9 painful months of back and forth, and it really just first adding stuff in, then pulling stuff out, but it got better every time, and I learned a lot. With every piece, the role of the editor is something I don't think people understand, but they are the coach.
And that's the one place where in a different time relationship, it is a team.
Yes, it's a team, but more in a way that you have a kind of partner in it that's pushing you, that coach, that nag, to get things done. But the writing, I think, feels like it fills a different part of what I need. I don't think I could do without some connection in the real world, and that's partly what surgery gives me, is a reality check. And the writing, which lets you try to connect the patterns of what you're doing, I feel like in the trenches, you can quickly lose sight and just be mired in the daily politics and struggles and the difficulties of the paperwork and the back and forth and all the things that get in the way of making it a kind of rewarding and satisfying experience. And the writing lets me remember why I was doing this in the first place.
Uh-huh. And it lets you, as I said in the top, you write about the physical details in a very, you know, graphic way, but it's all, but you're also always looking at this wider context.
Yeah. If I can begin to make it so you can even smell what's going on in an operating room and see the ideas that underlie it, I felt like I've won. I've been able to write something that's right.
Yeah. And one of the things, I'm going to stick with the writing for just a few more minutes. When I'm not on the radio, what I do is I coach folks, mostly nonprofits and foundations, on communications. The most popular thing I do is teach them to tell better stories. Okay? So, if you, who, you know, definitely tell stories, you have experiences, you tell stories to illustrate and communicate ideas. I noticed Malcolm Gladwell reviewed your book on Amazon. That's high praise. What would your advice be to people that you've learned along the way that makes a better story?
One of the interesting things is that because medicine is so vivid, that people in medicine often feel like they've got hundreds of stories to tell. And one of the things that strikes me is that just because it's dramatic and vivid doesn't mean that there's a story there. People have heard about the dramatic car crash and the patient dying on the table story. The hard part is the idea that makes the story different from the others or interesting. Most of my stories start as a question I don't know the answer to, and then I end up finding a case or something that happens that illuminates it for me. So, for example, one article for The New Yorker ended up starting out with a patient who came to me with trouble saying that her surgical incision was itching. And I realized I don't really understand what itching is and where it comes from and why someone would have such a problem. And that led to realizing, well, investigating what the science was, and then coming across a case where a woman had such a terrible itch that she scratched through her own skull.
I read that piece.
And it didn't, you know, the stories start with the case, of course, because that's what's vivid and that's what gets you in. But the stories really started with the question. And I think that when I give advice to folks, I say, what is it that you're interested in? I'm often writing to solve questions that I don't understand. Perry Class, who's a physician writer who I know who's in Boston, she's a pediatrician and has written some great stuff. She writes to understand relationships. And the questions she has are and so she looks at, you know, the doctor's relationship with the family or doctor's relationships with each other. I talked to Steven Bergman, who wrote under the name Samuel Shem a book called House of God in the 1970s. And he said to me, he writes to stick it to the man. You can have
so different
reasons.
So he's answered his question.
He's answered his question, but he's going in with a reason to be looking at what is otherwise a very dramatic situation. And that's your lens.
Mm-hmm. Now, that makes very good sense. And you've said also you think in stories.
Yes, I think I do. In fact, one of the difficulties in talking on the radio, I'm not a soundbite guy. I want to tell the story and then unpack it is the way my head works.
That's one reason I try to do hour-long interviews,
right.
So you actually have time to do that.
Well, and if I can flip my brain around, I give the unpacking first and then tell the story so it's easier for people to see. But I do. I see the story that makes me wonder why I'd say confusing or emotional or complicated story. It lets me recognize the realities and then unpack them.
Very good, very good. And you said in a 2005 Harvard Med School commencement speech, I'm going to read.
You're going back with me.
I'm going to read a quote. By putting your writing out to an audience, even a small one, you connect yourself to something larger than yourself. An audience is a community. The published word is a declaration of membership in that community and also of concern to contribute something meaningful to it.
Yeah, even when you say something in a blog or in your community newsletter, people always come up to you afterwards and say, I saw what you wrote. And in some sense, it's an act of bravery to say what you think because you're opening yourself up to the world, but you're also saying, I care.
Yeah.
I care enough about the community that's reading this to actually spend some time putting the words down and saying, making a small observation about, or sometimes a big observation, about what is going on.
Yeah. It's interesting because people think of the surgeon as an individual, yet you say, you know, surgery is a team effort. Writing is individual, and yet you tie that to the community. So I see, you know,
yeah,
this certain
place.
You're
speaking to somebody.
Yeah. One of the points I saw you make was that 97% of the time in medicine, everything goes right.
That's right. In hospitals, whether it's the operating room or otherwise, 97% of the time, things, you know, in studies that we do pretty well. But when we're talking about millions of people going to hospitals, 50 million people having operations, the 3% where it doesn't go right is not a small matter.
Right. That's the number. I mean, that number of whether it's 100,000 deaths a year or something has been something I know I've been reading about, talking about for a decade at least.
Yeah.
And you're obviously, you start with questions as a surgeon. That's a question, is how do we solve that? I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that a checklist is a new idea.
Yeah, it is.
How is that so?
Yeah. So the problem we were handed by the World Health Organization was that there was an explosion in the amount of surgery in the world because people were living longer due to the improvement in economic conditions over the last couple decades, living to the point that now infectious disease is no longer the number one killer in the world. It's not diarrheal illness, for example. It's now cardiac disease. And road traffic accidents are a top five killer. Cancers are in the top 10. People are living longer to get cancer.
So while this may have been true in the U.S. and other, you know, advanced countries for a while, it's now spread globally.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so the amount of surgery in the world has exploded. It's a quarter billion operations a year. It has exceeded the number of childbirths, but with death rates 10 to 100 times higher. So it's suddenly become a public health issue. And when you have that level of harm, over a million deaths a year, what do you do about it? We've used two main tools in medicine to handle the complexity of doing something as complicated as surgery. And that has been train and train and train and train. So we've specialized and super specialized and created more and more compartmentalized people. And we've added more and more technology. The thing is that despite all of that, we in the United States have over 150,000 deaths after surgery. We know half appear to be avoidable with knowledge that exists. And we have not employed a tool which folks in aviation have. Actually, in most professions, we've not employed the tool that aviation folks have embraced, which is the idea of a checklist for professionals. We feel like the whole point of becoming an expert is having enough experience that you know what to do. And pulling out a checklist is a sign of weakness, if anything else. It feels like you're just dumbing things down, and that's what you do for folks who are untrained. But the aviation world really had a different set of values that they embraced. The idea of using a checklist is a set of values, and it says we are humble enough to recognize that our brains will fail at times, even when you're an expert, that you need an aid to make sure things don't fall between the cracks. And their checklists are designed to handle teamwork, to make sure the teams have things together. And so it also embraces a value that it's not just the individual who matters here. This isn't just the surgeon's show when you bring a checklist in the operating
room.
Which
is where that sort of personal, this is below me, comes in, right? Is in that if it's just my show and just my ego, et cetera.
Yeah, we as surgeons expect the nurses to have run through checklists, and nurses have embraced it for half a century. They make sure that the contact lenses are out on the patient before they come to the operating room, and that that there's no dentures in, and those kinds of critical things that can lead to harm. But when it comes to going through the decisions that I have to make as a surgeon, do I have to check? My gosh, why would I? I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, otherwise, I wouldn't be here. If you will, I think this is an opportunity, as you do in the book, to share a couple of stories of situations where either a checklist wasn't present or a checklist was.
Well, it's not hard to find the stories of situations where a checklist wasn't present. An example is a patient of mine, a patient who came to me, who had an emergency operation for a splenectomy removal. He was bleeding terribly, came into the emergency room in shock, rushed to the operating room, and they followed through every step correctly, removing the spleen, getting things under control, really saving his life. Except one. When you've taken out a spleen, there are three vaccines you have to give, because the spleen handles three kinds of bacteria that if you don't have the spleen, you need to have that vaccine against. They forgot to give the vaccine. 2 years later, he got a pneumococcal infection that spread throughout his body because his spleen wasn't there. They saved him from it, the infection, but he lost all his fingers and toes. I've seen this error happen in my own hospital, too.
Wow, and I must say, that's one that I'm surprised by, because it seems like spleen equals vaccine.
That's right.
Would be, some of the other cases you said, the one about the person who came in on Halloween with a stab wound.
Yes.
And it turned out you figured, this wasn't your case, but they figured knife. They did what they would do for knife, and it turned out there was enormous internal bleeding. The person almost died on the table because the weapon on Halloween was a bayonet.
That's right. The other guy was dressed as a soldier.
And rips out. But this spleen, with a lack of vaccine, that one sort of shocks me. Is it because it was an emergency?
No, because the decision-making after everything's calm, you have time. Any time in the first couple weeks after the operation, you can give the vaccine.
But it's
that you have to have groups of people working together in ways that often will think, oh, the resident's taking care of that. The resident might think the attending surgeon's going to take care of it in the office. The attending surgeon thinks the primary care physician's going to take care of it. Or people just forget.
Yeah. No, I get it now. In other words, it isn't that they need the vaccine that moment, but they need the vaccine.
Yeah.
So there's So that kind of case with a checklist will work. Now,
Let me give you so the interesting thing about how we've designed our checklist is to face the reality that there is no recipe for every single operation and every single thing you have to do. You have 4,000 different kinds of medical and surgical procedures, and we're just entering this world. So what we did was we learned from Boeing how they designed their checklist for the airline world, where you have to make it so that they're useful even in a situation where you have a crashing plane, tremendous stress, only 2 minutes to act. And a lot of it is about being able to focus on the killer items you don't want to miss for people, and on making teamwork work. So in the operating room, we made a checklist that we timed to only be under 2 minutes for people to execute in normal practice. And the checks are some dumb things. Make sure an antibiotic is given. Make sure blood is available before you make your incision. But the other things are really interesting. Make sure everyone on the team has been introduced by name and role. Make sure that the surgeon, the anesthesiologist, and nurse have each had a chance to say what their plans are and what their concerns for the operation are. At the end of the operation, it doesn't spell out everything you're supposed to do. It just says, make sure everybody on the team has thought together out loud what are the things that have to be part of the plan for the recovery of the patient. And at that moment, at the end of the splenectomy, is when someone in the room is far more likely to remember, oh yeah, we can't forget that this patient has to have vaccines, and that needs to be put in the orders when they leave the room.
So
you're busy high-fiving. we saved this
right,
guy.
Right, right.
And you got to take that moment to pause and say, is there anything we could be forgetting? And that's what that little 19-item checklist was. What when we implemented in 8 hospitals around the world, and we deliberately went to some of the top places: University of Washington, Seattle, Toronto, London, Auckland, and poor places: rural Tanzania, New Delhi in India, Jordan, Philippines. And in every hospital, we had a reduction in complications. The average reduction in complications and deaths was over 1/3.
That is phenomenal. Now, I think what I'm getting then is that there isn't a special one for splenectomies.
Well, we may reach that point. The aviation world started out with a simple set of checks for any kind of airplane. And then eventually they've developed checks for each kind of airplane and each kind of situation the airplane might run into. And we probably will evolve in that direction. But there's a set of principles here that they've embraced. Also, people in the construction world embraced for building really these immensely high skyscrapers, it's that you can't reduce it all to a recipe. And so your most important thing you do is you have a series of checks in place that don't take power away from people. Instead, make it more likely they can use their brains effectively as a group of people. And so it emphasizes that you're going to have situations that you as a team have to be able to make the decisions on the spot. But have you communicated? Do you know who you are and what your roles are? Are you clear about your goals before you start? And it sounds really dumb. We do this every time you have a committee meeting with six people in a room trying to come to a decision. And yet you can walk out of that setting into your expert world, and it's not just true in medicine. There's a 36% increase in the last 3 years for which we have data in lawsuits against lawyers for legal mistakes. Most common mistakes are clerical and calendar screw-ups, and also errors in applying the law. And the legal world has been telling, when I've spoken to them, like, what is going on? They describe an increase in specialization and division of responsibilities and communication drops that underlie this. And we saw it with the terror incident and our inability to keep the bomber off the plane. This is about making people out at the edges more effective, not just about dictating what everybody has to do.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting that if you have certain principles in place and if you make sure to communicate, that communication can't be taken for granted, can't be rushed through, that sort of thing, that seems to be crucial. If there's anything more that you want to say about the checklist, can they, for instance, let me ask this, how has it been received?
Well, I think this is an important part of it, which is that we're tremendously resistant to it in medicine and in many other fields. Your idea of yourself as an expert and what your role is.
Let me cut in for a second. In other words, the place where it's most necessary is where complexity is deepest, which is where expertise is highest. And so...
Yeah, the irony here is that, let me put it this way, when we surveyed people 3 months after they had used the checklist, there was a real shift. In the beginning, people were very skeptical, but 80% at the end said, actually, you know what, it wasn't that hard to use, it improved our teamwork, and we caught errors. But there was still 20% who did not like it, said, this is a waste of my time, it takes too long, it doesn't make anything better, we were already doing fine without this. And then we asked them one more question. If you were having an operation, would you want the team to have used a checklist? 93% said they did.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's a reflection, I think, of how we think of what it means to be great at what we do. We have great confidence in ourselves and no confidence in other people. And this is, I think, a really fundamental idea that I'd love to be able to briefly get at. We have made a transition in our world from dealing with problems of ignorance, that is, we didn't have the science to understand how to grapple with illness or our natural world. At the end of the last century in particular, we've developed such a volume of knowledge, it's exceeded our individual capabilities as experts, and so we've now begun to grapple with a problem of what the philosophers have labeled ineptitude, meaning knowledge exists, but people aren't applying it correctly. And what is important here is that the public is losing trust in experts of all kinds because they were willing to forgive experts and leaders when what we were doing was grappling with a world of ignorance. Because if you saved my life a century ago, you were a miracle worker. And in fact, you were. You were grappling with mystery and doing the best you could against it. And we forgave leaders when they failed. Not anymore. Not when your failures are because of ineptitude. What do you mean my mother picked up an infection in the hospital and is now in the intensive care unit because someone didn't wash their hands? What do you mean three different people had information that could have kept the bomber off that plane and didn't put it together? This is one of the underlying reasons that we have the anger of a tea party looking at the Ivy League experts who say, I know how to run the businesses of our world. I know what you need for your medical care. This is why this is one of the reasons I've come to this kind of discussion, is that there's a set of values underlying this, which has to be humility about our abilities in the face of the complex ambition of what we're trying to pull off. And if we don't convey that, and if we don't recognize it, we not only will fail to take the opportunity to save lives, we will lose trust. And that's fundamentally important. The second part is, I think it connects with reform. Because in the effort to try to actually not enter a world where what's needed is rationing, but instead recognize that the best places in the country are actually among our lowest cost places in the country for healthcare.
That was my next question.
These are places that are becoming more systematic about not having just individual silos of care. The doctor who says, you know, I want this operation for you done, or the CT scan, or whatever, but then isn't connecting to making the whole system of care work in ways that ensure that the harm is reduced, the quality is higher, and also that you're not wasting resources along the way, making unnecessary moves or harmful moves.
And do you think that something like a checklist, or perhaps what you're saying is the results of the implementation of a checklist, will actually affect that kind of thing?
Our health reform.
Like, in other words, I mean, the people talk about practicing defensive medicine, and it's not defense against disease, it's defense against lawsuits and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the deeper idea here is that health reform is been focused on the debates have been focused on the insurance arguments and what are all the insurance companies doing. But where the costs and quality issues really happen are when the clinician is sitting with the patient and trying to make decisions about, do we get the CT scan? What do we really do here? And how do we actually keep you healthy? And we have two big problems. The incentives run in the wrong direction, and we aren't using the tools that can make it better. I'll give you a clear example. For asthma, a children's hospital whose president I spoke to had tried out a project where they made a series of checks to improve the care for kids with asthma. And the checks were, first of all, involved things that you normally aren't paid for. Make sure a phone call goes to the family so that you're sure the kids are actually have their inhalers and are using them. Make sure there's a home inspection for mold and dust mites. Things like that. Secondly, when they implemented it and asked people in their organization to follow through on making things happen for their group of patients, they cut their rate of admissions by more than 80%.
80%? That's phenomenal.
For that group of patients, absolutely phenomenal. And saved money and improved health. The third thing, guess what their number one source of revenue is? Admissions for kids with asthma are their number one source of revenue. If they worked on this project and expanded it to their whole population, they were looking at bankrupting themselves. And reform has had to be about not just the insurance issues, but making it so that at that front-end decision-making level, we are working not against ourselves to make people healthy, but in the right direction. We don't know the master plan for making it so that this happens. We know that the fee-for-service system that only pays you when the patient is admitted and only pays the doctor when the patient's sitting in front of them and they're going through decision-making.
And seems to, in the current world at least, pay them for sure when they do a procedure.
That's right. We're paid
or pay someone for sure when they give a prescription.
We're paying individuals for quantity instead of organizations to achieve quality.
Wellness, yeah.
And there are incentives in the health reform plan now to make it so that you not only are starting to create this panoply of checks in place, learn how to do that, but provide the incentives to do it. But it means medical communities really reinventing themselves at the front line. So, for example, bundling the care. There's experiments in giving communities a incentive to pay a bundled price for asthma, for example, that those kids would, whether they're being seen in the hospital or in the doctor's office or wherever, the care of their population for the month or the year would be a bundled fixed price, that there'd be measures of quality, and if people were raising quality and lowering costs, we'd see whether this is working as a way. It's a great idea. We don't know completely for sure we can make it work right, and it involves big changes in the way doctors are paid and arguments among doctors about who gets the money and all those things. But it's the ones we need to be having right now. And so that's why this really links together. It's why I'm writing about this now. This is our next step for making a better health system.
Very good. That connection is really important. One of the things you were just talking about when you were, and I found you saying about the health reform package, is that I do agree that most of the arguments have been about insurance, about abortion, about those sorts of things. One of the things that when certain things that progressives favored were not likely to show up in the bill, then there were the series of articles by folks saying, well, it's still worth it. And one of the things that I saw that I hadn't seen at all until that point was that embedded in there are a lot of pilot programs, experiments, like a wide range of things that haven't been tried or haven't been, government policy that are going to be tried. We don't know what's going to work, what's going to not, but that this is really a big piece of this.
Yeah, when you hear that, in fact, the Republicans made great fun of this. Against costs, we're going to do pilot programs. It's wimpy. It's weak. This is going to just explode as a cost, and we shouldn't even embark on the experiment.
Oh, right. If they all work, we'll be.
Yeah.
We'll be.
Yeah. I don't believe it. It's not going to happen. I think there's still an open question whether we can succeed in making all of it work. The thing is that there's a set of beliefs among some people that the only way to make it work is rationing. And then there's another group of people who say, look, we'll never even have the stomach for rationing, therefore you shouldn't cover the population in under any circumstance because we'll never be able to afford it as a country. And this is really observing that we have knowledge of some communities that are higher quality and lower cost medicine. They include places like Kaiser Permanente, where the physicians are on salary and really focus on being organized together.
So that goes against that fee for service.
It does. It goes against the way most physicians are paid in the country. We see it in places like Cleveland Clinic, Mayo, the Mayo Clinic, which are achieving extremely high levels of quality, and for their local communities, lower intensity of care. They're less likely to be over-treating or under-treating patients. But we don't know how to take that model and put it in a brand new place. How do you put it in a Texas community like the one I talked about, where really, it's one of the most expensive places in the country for health care. Medicare costs are twice what it is in another community that has also a border town, and El Paso and McAllen were the two places I compared, and McAllen was twice as expensive as El Paso. And the reasons were the disorganization of care, a culture that really emphasized the business opportunities of medicine, and bringing communities that are high cost, and actually it was achieving lower quality than the place that cost half as much, El Paso. Bringing communities across the country that are struggling with these questions to try new forms of organization, this is a big deal.
And, let me just say, by the way,
experiments.
This, if one goes to Gawande.com, that's the article called
The Cost Conundrum.
The Cost Conundrum, and it's where he compares. It's really powerful stuff. Again, comparing two similar communities with outrageously different costs. Let me ask a question that is about the insurance, or is about the numbers of costs. It has always seemed to me, or I've always assumed, that if one compares, for instance, single payer or Medicare for all, that it has the distinct advantage of lower administrative overhead, whether that's you don't need to make a profit, you don't need to advertise and market nearly as much, you don't need as much paperwork and so on. And I believe the numbers are something like 4% overhead for Medicare and something like 20%, and I think I'm being pretty conservative in both cases, for private health insurance. To me, that's 16 more cents of every dollar that's going to healthcare or not going to healthcare. Is there a compelling argument against that?
Well, on one level, no. It's a question of the public has been, there's a large portion of the public that feels that having that control in government of having a single entity controlling healthcare is taking away their freedom. And we are in a fierce argument over a set of values here, whether that price is worth it or not. Real test here,
though. I was going to say, take into account the fact that most of them will or already, or their parents are already on Medicare.
So no, absolutely. And you'll have the arguments of people who come out and say, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. And we don't love the insurance companies. We don't feel that they're any, you know, better bureaucracies than the ones we deal with in the government. What reform is now going to pose a test to, and I think it's actually going to be a very interesting next 5 to 10 years, is that the bills have provisions that make the insurers much more transparent and under rules that make it much harder for them to compete the way they used to. You can't cut people out by pre-existing conditions. This isn't going to be about risk pooling. This is going to be insurers that now with their, first of all, exactly how much they are spending that's not for medical care will be transparent from insurer to insurer, and you can actually, when you're choosing insurers, can look and see which one has the more money going to profit and overhead expenses and so on. But the second thing is that they have to prove that they provide value in the world. And this is still a competition now. Both Medicare and the private insurers are going to be working community by community to see if they're putting the right kinds of tools and pressures in place to bring doctors and hospitals to get higher quality and lower cost results. They are trying many of these approaches. Medicare has usually been the one that's out of the box faster in driving change that improves care and lowers cost. Neither one have managed to actually solve this problem in any lasting or substantive way. The real test for in my mind that I have for health reform is that in the next couple of years, there should be at least one community that says it is committed to making higher quality and actually lower costs, not just bend the curve.
By community, you mean a geographic community?
I mean it's a town, a city, a county that says we will be about the solution. And then they will take the tools that include what private insurers offer, what the reform plan offers, and begin trying to do it. It means changing the way their doctors are paid, learning to bring that kind of Kaiser model or other approaches to their towns and change. And we will learn very quickly who's a help, who's not a help. I think of reform, people talk about reform, that when it comes to coverage, it will be historic. It is a huge investment of subsidies to help make it so that the people have access to coverage. I, as a cancer surgeon, have seen many patients through the years that because they didn't have coverage, were fighting for how to take care of their cancer. That will be gone. What won't be gone is the threats on cost. And this, we talk about reform as if it's a first step on doing something about cost. It's not. It's a toolkit. And the choices for us as local communities, and this is also as medical communities, my own colleagues, is whether we use that toolkit, begin trying those tools or not. And when we try them, we're going to learn, you know, I need a different tool. I need to change this one. We will have fierce discussions 3 or 4 years from now as we learn what's working. If it turns out, for example, that what's important for care of kids with asthma is that the teams that have salaried physicians do better than the ones without fee-for-service, we will have a national fierce argument 3 or 4 years from now about whether we make all physicians begin making that transition and whether now, it may turn out there's a different answer, but whatever the answer turns out to be.
Or whatever combination of.
It's going to be a fierce fight to come. And the conservatives who attack are correct to say that we may not go through it. The lobbyists will gut whatever lessons come out. That's often happened in the past. We've had pilot programs that showed us good things, and a lobbyist killed it. But if we don't try, then it's saying that we can't fix healthcare. We're doomed as an economy. We've killed off our auto industry. We'll kill off some more and, you know, throw up our hands. That's it. I don't think that's the way we are as a country. What's amazed me is despite the fierceness of the anger and arguments that have been swirling around this, it has kept moving forward. We're at the brink of a transformative change, an effort to actually solve a major problem.
An effort to solve. In other words, we're not on the brink of solving it.
That's correct. Some of these are going to take.
Of taking it seriously and making some changes,
we haven't gotten there. So you know, even just the idea that in the last 10 years that we've taken on problems of this size, we haven't had the guts to do it. We haven't had the guts to take on the environmental issues. We haven't had the guts to take on our energy issues. This, if we kill this, it's saying we can't do it.
Yeah.
Across the board, we can't even start.
Yeah. Unlike so many people that might be a doctor talking about healthcare reform, actually worked in the White House under Clinton when they were putting forward their plan and so on. Obama, it seems to me, and he didn't just do it with healthcare, he's done it with climate And it seems to be his method. He outlines broad principles and then throws it to Congress, which, given the way the rules are, ultimately means the Senate. And I believe the Senate, and he knows this, having been a senator, is the body most beholden to campaign funders.
Yeah.
And so that's where we see Max Baucus, who gets only 13% of his funds from the state of Montana. The 87% comes from people who like his position on the Finance Committee. Kent Conrad, very similar situation. Joe Lieberman from a state where insurance might be the largest industry, end up having enormous power. Is that any way to arrive at the best solution?
Well, I'm not a campaign finance reform expert here, but what has become clear to me is that part of what's exacerbated the influence of money is the power of the filibuster and the idea that the 41st senator is someone with unbelievable power. We have a campaign right now in Massachusetts with the election coming up very, very soon where the Republican is running to say he will be the 41st senator who will kill health reform.
And that's actually his campaign.
That's his campaign.
Wow.
That I can be the 41st. And there's something wrong when we've allowed that, what essentially amounts to less than 15% of the population, which in the Senate can elect the minority of people, enough that they have power to stop what the majority in the country want to achieve. So where I trace a lot of this is that we will have a lot to do to continue to improve our campaign finance rules, but what I think we really have to get after is that sense of the filibuster rules. I know in California as well, it's the struggle over
the two-thirds vote.
The two-thirds vote. It's the empowering of paralysis that it gets created.
Or this thing in the last budget battle or the last budget that got passed here, one state senator ended up getting to, at some midnight meeting, getting to say, I want this, this, and this. And because it came down to one. And in some sense, Lieberman's done the same thing in the Senate.
And that's where the lobbyists then become very powerful, because all you got to do is get one person. You don't have to bring the community. You just have one person. And that's where power works.
And that's where it's so anti-democratic. And as you probably know, you said you're not an expert on campaign reform, but maybe by the time this airs, the Supreme Court will have made their ruling on campaign finance, in which they are very likely, or they are expected, to remove all limits on corporate contributions. If that's news to you, that's a scary one.
Well, and I think what the key, I think, here is that how is it that the campaign finance has its power? It is by being able to take advantage of rules that give power to even just a single person to stop things cold in the face of what the majority considers important. And I think the filibuster rule has been damaging.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that even that another place of leverage,
yeah,
even if the Supreme Court rules thusly and we have to deal with all that, is by working within the Senate rules. I think that would take a great deal of courage, and I certainly hope it happens. Finally, I know you listen to your iPod in surgery. What are you listening to these days? What are you reading?
Oh, great. latest download, probably Vampire Weekend's new album, Contra, which I really like. The band, I think everybody should know about, but is Frightened Rabbit out of Scotland. Unbelievable last album called Midnight Organ Fight. Haven't new single, and I love them, and they get no attention, and I think they're really interesting. New book. Reading Petrovskaya's book. It's a collection of macabre fables called The Woman Who Tried to Kill Her Neighbor's Baby.
Wow. Okay. What was that music group again?
Frightened Rabbit.
Frightened Rabbit. Okay, you heard it here first. Atul Gawande's latest book is The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. His website is Gawande, GAWANDE.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly at my site or on iTunes. For podcast articles and transcripts, or to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net. That's one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement, email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. Thank you, Atul Gawande, and keep up the good work.
Harris, thank you.